Hey, it's True Crime Tuesday. I'm John. I'm here with Kendra tonight. We're going to talk about a very articulate, strangely tall, weirdly kind of fat, weird guy that's obsessed with true crime. No, the show's not about me. It's about a completely different guy. Today, we're going to tell the story of Brian Cohey Jr., weirdo.
The growing calls across the nation to defund the police.
To end policing as we know it.
With the mysterious disappearance of four people.
The police found what they called an unusual amount of blood in the family home, though whose blood is unclear.
And the suspect isn't talking.
Guns up, giddy up, Wolfpack, it's failure to stop. Number one podcast and platform where we entertain and inform first responders and their friends. And joining me as always is my ex-wife, Kendra Drama. She's a former sheriff's deputy from somewhere down in America's Wang. I'm John. I'm an active 911 dispatcher. I've been doing that in the field for 9 years. We are a first responder podcast, which means we are here every week to honor the victims, to do justice for the victims, by telling a complete story, including all the scurrilous lies and hearsay that could never be admissible in court. And then we're also going to bitch and complain when the police don't make an arrest. And we get all of our sources from civil documents and other podcasts. Kendra, last week on three separate shows, or on three separate shows so far, I have been still mad about that Ayla Reynolds guy. So I've spent the last week seething with rage and naming an ulcer after him. What is the completely made up fucking bullshit story that you have to share with the audience this week to convince them that you're a real person?
Well, I went grocery shopping on, I think, was it Thursday maybe? And I'm just wandering through the store. I'm only there for one thing, kombucha, which I did purchase. I knew you'd roll your eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of strolling along and I see a bunch of sales. I'm like, you know what? I just got paid. I'm going to go grocery shopping. And I'm looking around and I see this oat creamer in the refrigerated section. And I don't usually drink anything in my coffee. I drink it black, no sugar, nothing. I just put it in a cup and I go. But this one caught my eye, not because it was oat creamer, but because it was mint chip flavored. And mint and chocolate is my favorite sweet combination of flavors. Salt and vinegar is my favorite savory. So I got this oat creamer and it was on sale and it's delicious. I'm drinking it right now, actually.
Very nice. I'll try to get you some salt and vinegar creamer for your coffee.
I really want that.
I believe you, actually.
What's your favorite cream?
I asked this last Thursday or the Thursday before one show. I don't know. But what is your favorite grocery?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Save it for next week, maybe.
Can I just go with a category?
Yeah. Drew said that he likes frozen foods. I said I liked cereal, but he said, oh, you're kind of a dry foods man.
So I love to cook, so I really like fresh ingredients, so I like produce, but down here we have Publix, and Publix has such a good freaking deli and prepared food section that I think I'm going to have to go with prepared food section. That's my favorite grocery from Publix.
Prepared food?
They make food there.
Okay. All right. That's fine. My friend...
They make like pop salads and like... really good just like sides. It's like a deli.
I mean, you're lazy. My friend April said in the chats that night, she said asking someone what their favorite grocery is the 40-year-old equivalent of asking someone what their favorite dinosaur is.
That's fair.
All right, Kendra agrees. Folks, the show is brought to you by Ghostbed. Ghostbed's a website that sells mattresses. You can go over to that website, and by using the offer code Wolfpack, which is just for you, you can save up to 40% on that website. Ghostbed is a wonderful website that supports veterans and first responders and failure to stop since long before I got here and probably long after I am forced to leave. Dragged away, kicking and screaming, just as has been outlined in my contract. With 0% down and 0% financing, you could go over there with Brian Coey credit and still get an excellent deal. They offer Christopher Nolan special lasagna-style sleep in which you go to sleep and dream of being asleep, and you can get up to 16 hours of solid first responder sleep in just 4-hour nap. So go on over there, use the offer code Wolfpack. And of course, we love GhostBed also because they're the only mattress company on earth that makes their mattresses in the good old USA. USA. Kendra hates the United States, and I literally saw her. If you don't follow her on Instagram at True Crime Drama, she literally took down the Stars and Stripes and ripped it in half lengthwise the other day on an Instagram story, which I thought was a bold move. And also, like, it's not even 4th of July, so what are you rebelling against right now? I don't know. Anyway, go over to ghostbed.com, use the offer code Wolfpack. If you're sleeping, you're probably eating. Both are signs that you're alive. Go over to Factor Meals, use the offer code Wolfpack50. You could save 50% off on your first week to start. They have over 300 options. You could choose broccoli. You could choose corn. You can choose beans. Whatever it is your favorite grocery, stop getting it from the grocery store and have it delivered to your house, reverse trick-or-treat style. Go on the website. Set it all up in advance. You don't have to eat when you're hangry, lonesome, angry, tired, whatever stupid frailty you're going through. You can actually avoid eating in the midst of that by setting it up all up in advance. It'll come to your house after you're done saving the world from its own stupidity, ignorance, and all that. And your kids are fussy or whatever. You don't have to put up with that. Go over to the fridge. The Factor meal's already inside. 2 minutes in the microwave and you got a meal just like what mom used to make if, in fact, your mother did love you. For me, I have no idea. I have to have Factor Meals to attempt to grasp what it would be like if mother had loved me. Wolfpack 50 is the offer code that you should use. We appreciate them supporting us as always. And then, of course, let's not forget the wellness company. You can own your wellness. You can own your health and your freedom with the wellness company. Get well and stay well with solutions that are designed by top doctors. These are the doctors that you could trust. These are not the doctors who are making a various claims on late night TV that if you eat your pills, like, you know, the hair's going to stay on your head or whatever. And these are not the dentists that overwhelmingly approve a certain type of toothbrush. Well, like, we don't get to even talk to the fifth dentist who isn't okay with it. They offer natural supplements, melatonin to help you have long, bizarre dreams, immune support, daily essentials for your mind and body, digestion, and metabolism. If you're as old as me, you need at least 3 pills every day just to feel normal, and you can get that from the wellness company. Prescription medications like antibiotics, you can stock up before the next insane emergency, medical first aid kit, contagion kits, get a membership, free yourself from Big Pharma, break away from Pfizer's chains at the wellness company. You can get 10% off with the offer code Wolfpack. So we appreciate that. Go on over there. Thank you to the wellness company for supporting us as always. Kendra, also, the show's brought to you by Zaps Chips. Kendra's incapacitated. I have no idea why.
Zaps is...
She's dying.
Oh, I'm out of focus now because I've... Oh, my God. Zaps literally, is...
Literally and visually, she is now out of focus.
Zaps is a chip that I hold near and dear to my heart. And I really wish that they would call me back. But... I love them so much that I just want them to be happy, so I'm going to talk about them anyway. They're a New Orleans-style kettle chip made in the USA. Their flavor, there's all kinds of different flavors, but my favorite personally is the voodoo chip, as you see pictured here to my stage right. I don't know. It's like a salt and vinegar chip and a barbecue chip all rolled into one, which happens to be my favorite coffee creamer flavor as well. So it's kind of like a 2-for-1. Sometimes I crumple up the Zaps and I just dump it right in my coffee and stir it around. You can eat them plain on a sandwich, in a sundae, whatever you want. I mean, and they're available anywhere. I would do horrific crimes for a bag of Zaps, but you don't have to because they're available at every store and grocery and convenience store that you can think of. Just look at the wrapping too. I mean, they just put so much love and effort into it. I don't know why they can't take a little bit of that effort and put it into me.
It's a Mylar bag puffed with air with chips inside of it. And a former law enforcement officer says she will commit egregious crimes for these chips. That's probably Kendra's favorite snack. I know you won't ask because we've been through a bitter divorce. But as you know, my favorite snack is every night before I go to bed, I take a big spoonful of peanut butter and I keep it in my cheek for when I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm hungry and I just swallow it and go back to sleep without having to get up like a chump.
I don't know if it's the mint chip that's got me all excited or if it's the lateness of the hour, but you're killing me right now. I cannot stop laughing.
It is especially late tonight. Kendra, I took some heat last week for man casting that podcast in which I did most of the heavy lifting. I had some neat accents. I think I told the story well. I think I honored you. I think I honored your tradition. And but this week, you know, I'm pretty much just going to leave and have you do it.
No, I want you to still interact. Don't leave.
Okay. Well, I've prepared a media package in the true style of me that starts at a 911 phone call. But I want you to tell us a little bit about Brian Cohey. I want you to talk about the incident at the Blue Heron and bring our audience up to speed on what was probably the most bizarre murder of the last few years.
Yeah, so Brian Cohey, this story takes place in Grand Junction, Colorado, which is kind of in this. It's in the same state that Deadleg's in. I don't know. I don't know where he's at in Colorado, but he's out there somewhere. Perhaps he was an accomplice. We don't know.
Maybe it's not a good idea to liken Brian Cohey to Deadleg because the only difference between Brian Cohey and Deadleg is that Deadleg is confined to a wheelchair.
Sometimes.
Which doesn't make him more likable, as you damned well know.
Not all times.
I don't trust him because he's a cripple. He knows.
Well, Brian Cohey is one of two sons to Terry and Brian Sr. Cohey. They're a pretty regular family. They are a... Oh my God, I'm just thinking about Deadleg.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. This episode has been derailed already because John's got me laughing about
when we were in North Carolina last year, I grabbed him and pushed him into the street to see if he was really crippled because cars were coming. And I knew that if he wasn't, he would get out of that chair. But the stupid cars, people are so nice in the South, they just stopped and helped him. What the fuck?
Oh my God. Anyway.
Brian Cohey.
Brian, the Cohey family seems pretty normal from the outside, but when you start digging into who Brian is, as a person, things are kind of a little off. He was diagnosed with ADHD and autism and a couple of other things that I can't remember off the top of my head, but
he's also that one weirdo that we all went to school with, you know?
Yeah, his friends describe him as kind of like a little, he's got dark sense of humor. He liked to rile people up and say outlandish things and ask people weird questions about dead bodies. And he just had a morbid curiosity.
Kind of a doofus, though, too.
Do what now?
He's kind of a doofus.
Yeah, he doesn't do really well in school. He bounces around to a couple of different high schools and middle schools because he gets bullied.
He also brings nunchucks to school one day.
He brings weapons. He makes weapons, too, out of masking tape and hits.
Now, I was joking earlier about pushing a crippled man, crippled former police officer to the lane of travel. I was joking about that. But this a-hole, Brian Cohey, literally made a medieval weapon out of masking tape and beat a disabled disabled person with it. So my joke is Brian Cohey's reality, just to make that perfectly clear.
Yes, and I'm not laughing at the fact that a special needs individual was assaulted by this man, but it's just a little silly to think about.
There was another occasion where he knew a student had PTSD, was prone to anxiety attacks, and he knew what caused that, and he deliberately antagonized her until she had some sort of severe event. So he's just, you know, got no empathy for other human beings. We had a lot of these kids back in the 90s, to be honest with you, Kendra.
Yeah, he was also obsessed with the Columbine shooting and a couple of different serial killers. It was rumored that he'd killed a couple of neighborhood cats, which later turned out he admitted to. So that's kind of a sign, but his parents don't really take a lot of, they're not very alarmed by this, which is alarming in and of itself. And I have a little bit of a rant to get into about that later, but.
Oh, I've got a good solid parent rant, but I'm not doing it now because I'm going to let you rant this week.
In some of the interviews later on, you'll hear his parents, especially his mother, come to his defense a lot about him getting in trouble at school for some of the behavioral issues that he's having. They think that he's being singled out. You know, the typical kind of like my poor baby type thing.
Yeah.
Which is infuriating because of what happens later.
It's fairly infuriating. I'm going to tell you what right now. If my son was bringing weapons to school and picking on people and causing problems, I would take my kid out of school. And then when the cops are like, why are you taking him out of school? Like, this is against the law. I'd be just like, listen, my son's a fucking loser and it's a waste of taxpayer money. And he's just going to hurt somebody. So I'm putting him, he's going to go work at Taco Bell. And hopefully someday he can be the manager of Taco Bell. And that's as good as it gets for my fucking son, Brian. And if you don't believe me, why don't you go have a fucking conversation with him?
I thought you were going to say that I'm going to go put him down. When you were saying I'm going to go put him, I was like, what?
I'm going to go take him out behind the barn, tell him he's been a good son, and just totally of mice and men him.
I'm going to old yeller his ass. Anyway.
Is he getting rabies? Because that's the scenario in Old Yeller. Of mice and men, it's literally a guy that's like too weird to like be a part of the world, and that he's been blamed for carnal knowledge of a lady. And anyways, best friend tells him they're going to go out to get that rabbit farm, George, and then blows him away. Sorry for the spoiler alerts on Of Mice and Men, everyone. If I ruined one of John Steinbeck's greatest books that was published 100 years ago, I'm sorry. Sorry, I should have said spoiler alert.
There's been enough time between the publishing of that book and now.
Honestly, you should have read Of Mice and Men by now. I don't know what you were waiting for.
I know. Well, so... we only hear about Brian in this scenario. He has a brother. I don't know much about him. I think he's pretty normal. But Brian goes through school like this. He manages to graduate at some point. He shows an interest in forensics and like crime scene investigation and stuff like that. So that's kind of the trajectory that people are thinking he's going to go on. Again, there's so many people in his life that just kind of take this behavior that he shows and they just kind of brush it off as him being himself. So after he graduates, when he's like 19 years old, he's just chilling at home still. He hasn't gone to college yet. And he decides he's going to go. Well, this is the story he tells his parents. He's going to go clear his head. He's going to go for a drive.
After watching the family film 1984.
And reading Mice and Men. He goes for a drive and he ends up down at Blue Heron Boat Ramp, which is on the Colorado River in town there. It's pretty secluded. There's not much there. It's kind of like, if you look at some of the pictures and videos, it's a dirt road. There's power lines around. So it's kind of secluded.
Just as God intended.
Right. He parks his car on the boat ramp. He's chilling. And all of a sudden, his car starts to slide into the river.
Ah, shit.
He is now in a situation where he's, all I can think of is that scene in The Office when Michael Scott follows a GPS into the lake.
That's when I stopped watching that show, because that's when Michael Scott became full-on Homer Simpson. I thought that was so stupid. But let's be clear, what has actually happened that we find out through retrospect is, how did he wind up in the water? He was driving a Ford 500, which does not have four-wheel drive. He's going down the steep boat ramp. And he's backing the trunk towards the water.
Mm-hmm.
Kendra is a police officer. Let's suppose you're sitting in your Chevy Tahoe. You're listening to your police band radio. All kinds of terrible crimes in progress. But you ain't got time for that. So you turn that shit off. You turn on Delilah because you're listening to a love song. Because you're thinking about me and how we got divorced. And you're eating a donut and you're drinking your fucking salt and vinegar coffee. And you see this Ford 500 clearly backing up what is obviously going to be dumping a body in a burlap sack in classic mob style. Do you view that as suspicious? On the other hand, if you're just your regular old self, are you going to call the non-emergency number and report suspicious activity at the boat ramp? I mean, it's pretty fucking suspicious, right?
It's very suspicious, yeah. I would probably be at least getting out and saying what's up to the guy. If I
as
was
a cop or as a person?
As a cop. And as a person, I would be driving away and going to bed.
thank you for not actually calling in, because I would have been like, you know, people just fucking boat ramp, okay? It's not a big deal. Don't call communications. And then this guy would have gotten away with it. You know what I mean?
Right.
would have been my fault.
Well, Brian's backing his vehicle down towards the water, and it slides into the water, and his car's starting to float away. He manages to get out. That's February. It's cold out. He's kind of freaking out a little bit. So he goes up to the road to find some help.
His pants are off.
He's realizing, oh my gosh, I'm going to get hypothermia. So he smartly takes his clothes off.
Cotton kills.
And he manages to flag down some passersby who have really excellent names. Yes.
Flagging people down. Yeah. I was telling the story for the hearing impaired.
Okay. Doing a great job.
Thank you. They can tell what's happening perfectly.
these
I haven't even shown a picture of Brian Cohey. They have no idea what the fuck we're talking about.
Oh my god.
Keep going.
It's just you waving and like falling off of your chair. So anyway, I'm mentioning these guys because their names are really cool. It's Durwood and Keenan Pfeiffer. Pfeiffer, P-I-F-E-R.
Pfeiffer, okay.
Pfeiffer. So these two passersby let him use the phone. He contacts his mom. She comes down. Well, both of his parents come down. They see the car in the water. They call law enforcement, tow truck, all that stuff. Law enforcement shows up, and Terry, Brian Jr.'s mother, is explaining the situation, and she's like, oh, you know, he's an inexperienced driver, like, he just came down here to do whatever, blah, 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 mm-hmm. It's stupid. Mm-hmm. Blah.
Yeah.
Well,
ain't
he's
nothing criminal going on here, officer.
No.
In fact, he's allowed to leave the scene at one point, which makes no fucking sense.
Well, it's not technically a crash, and it's not...
Right, but at mom that point, is it's... still there, though. Because well, mom's not... still there talking to the police officer about what's happening after he leaves the scene. And she calls him while she's being interviewed about what's happening. So he's excused, possibly because he's cold and wet, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, because when you watch the body cam, they talk to everybody. And when they're talking to him, he's basically like, yeah, I'm cold. And the officer's asking him to get out. And he's like, well, I don't have any pants on. He's like, okay, don't get out. And then dad says he's really cold and he wants to go home.
Would you have done that? Because I didn't like the tactics of him staying in the car.
Well, think about the circumstance. You show up to that. It's not a crash. There's nothing suspicious at the moment.
I know, but I worked in the prison and I've seen so much Wang, it wouldn't have mattered.
Well, I would definitely have had my flashlight on, I think, a little bit more, because I don't like the dark vehicle, but they didn't handle it that way. And it's, you know, yeah. Everything turned out okay, kind of.
to be honest, the kid, you know, Brian handled himself very well. He was kind of aw shucks, embarrassed, and, you know, oh, man.
Very manipulative.
You know, very manipulative, very believable. You know, it's an absurd situation. So he kind of he leans into the absurdity of it. I'm like, yeah. So the cop's like, so you're not hurt, just your pride. And he goes, yeah, and about $7,000. And they're all laughing. And they're like, ho, what do we do about this? You know, a tow truck's not even going to be able to pull this out. And I'm like, idiots. They will literally just put a hook on a part of the drivetrain or frame and winch it out just like they do anything else. And yes. You don't need to worry about that. You just need to say 1031 and then I'll fucking worry about it. But anyway.
I feel like your codes are the same as ours.
They are. Yeah, there's only one place on Earth where they use wonky codes, and it's very near me, and I make fun of them all the time for it.
Well, we had a couple of agencies that were around us that have different...
You guys use NATO phonetics, didn't you?
Yeah, and 10 codes, and... Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, we went, and then we were supposed to stop. Everything was supposed to be plain talk, but that didn't happen.
I like brevity. I like brevity codes. By the time I'm done here, this entire podcast will be brevity codes.
All right. Can't wait. So anyway, They pull the tow truck gets there. They're kind of, you know, like you said, Brian has left the scene. He's gone home. Terry's still there. I believe his father is still there. Perhaps not, but at least Terry is there with the cops. And the tow truck has arrived and they're pulling the vehicle out. And the law enforcement officers notice something on the trunk of the vehicle. And they ask Terry, they're like, you know, there's a lot of red stuff coming from the trunk of this vehicle. And it looks like blood.
Oh, red stuff. Very, very like true crimey. I love it.
Red stuff.
Very true crimey. It's a classic it's a classic true crime scenario, just like that guy said last week about Ayla.
Classic.
Runner. It's a classic.
Now this is a lot of blood, and we have it smeared all over the back of the vehicle. It was described as if someone kind of like had a bloody hand and just like slipped off of it, like they were grabbing it.
Yeah. And I also heard there were torso shaped blood impressions.
Perhaps. No, I didn't hear that, but
what's torso shaped?
I don't know. So anyway, they introduce this new information to Terry, who calls Brian and says, "Hey Brian, are you injured? The law enforcement officers found what looks like blood on the back of the vehicle." And Brian's demeanor is like, if you're listening to it from this lens, knowing that he did what he did, he doesn't play it as cool. But if you don't really know what he's doing, or you didn't know what he did, you would not probably think that anything nefarious was going on. Cause he's like, "Oh, I have no idea. I'm fine." Like, apparently he had some sort of surgery in his armpit at one point and his mom thought it busted open. I can't hear you, John.
I just said how gross it was. The other thing he said was that he had done some crime scene tech stuff the previous semester or something, and that he had the fake blood that he was using for crime scene.
Yes.
And the bottle burst open, which makes perfect sense, which
yes,
is an explanation, but not a perfect one.
So the law enforcement officers see this. They hear the explanation. They kind of blow it off because in the heat of the moment, you're not thinking. I mean, it's suspicious if you look at a blood smear, like a stain or dried blood, you know what it is. Especially if you are a law enforcement officer and you've seen it a lot, you know exactly what it is. But to be fair, the vehicle's been in the water, excuse me, and it's dark. Like, I'm not sure what was going through these law enforcement officers' minds, but they give the vehicle back to the Cohees and everybody leaves the scene. The next morning, or that night anyway, when Brian Sr. gets back with the vehicle, he's looking through it and he finds a wallet.
Uh-oh.
Inside of this vehicle. It's in between the passenger side door and the seat, so it had fallen in the gap there.
It's a bit of a clue.
It's a little bit of a clue, considering the wallet belongs to a 69-year-old man named Warren Barnes.
That's not a son. His
Nobody
son is
knows
19-year-old. Now, you know how you can tell? His son's has the same name as him, Brian Cohee Jr. So this guy, you Warren Brown, different guy.
I've been researching this case all week. I've probably spent 6 hours on it. And I've never, ever put two and two together like that, John.
Well, it just goes to show you that dispatchers are the real detectives.
I mean, I should just quit now because, you know, what am I doing here?
I don't know.
You're the expert.
I don't know why I'm here either. Neither of us should be here.
On but Earth?
Yes. Let's just go get that toaster and have a bath. But the whole father son sharing a name thing will come back later. I'll mention that later if I think of it.
Okay. I'm excited to hear about that because I couldn't possibly.
Keep woman explaining what happened.
Okay, I'll keep going. So Brian Sr. obviously finds this a little strange. And he confronts Brian about it. And he's like, "What is this?" And he's like, "Oh, I don't know. I don't know how that got in there, Dad. I don't know how this strange man who I've never met's wallet ended up in my vehicle." So Brian's going through it. Brian Sr. Is going through it and he finds some cards, some business cards and things like that in it. And he calls a phone number on one of them to see who this guy is. He calls a woman who owns a shop downtown. And she's like, oh, yeah, that guy is, he's a local, he's a transient. And we haven't seen him in a while. He's been missing.
Not just a local transient. A beloved transient.
Community member.
This is the so weird about this case that everybody loved Warren Brown. They said that he just loved to sit around and read. He didn't do crack cocaine. He didn't try to shake people down for money. He never stabbed someone with a broken bottle. He never publicly urinated anywhere. He wasn't doing any of that classic tramp stuff that we all love so much. He was just like a regular guy who happened to like be a nomad and live outside. But
he liked to read a lot too.
Yes, he loved to read a good paperback, you know, some filthy smut, anything he could lay his hands on. The funniest part about it, don't you dare. Don't you? This is a classy podcast. Okay. But this is the funniest part about it, if I may. May I?
Sure.
Every true crime podcast victim is a most wonderful person without exception. No matter who gets killed in a true crime podcast, a whole community has nothing but positive things to say. She really loved life. She just loved her kids. She loved breathing every day. Loved, you know, doing all the life things and being alive. Really just everybody loved her. Everybody adored her. It's never just like, yeah, she fucking, you know, did crack and whored herself out on the streets. And it was just her whole life was a dance with death. And she was obnoxious. It's always, no matter what, the true crime person is always beloved. And it's even the case in the case of a guy who was specifically chosen because the killer in this case thought no one would love him. And Brian Coey is such a fuck up. He picks the world's most beloved transient.
Yeah, so moral of the story is don't be a lovable person. Don't be a good person if you want to live.
If you want to live, yeah. Yeah, if you're nice, you're going to get killed.
Yes. So anyway, Brian Sr. contacts this woman and she's explaining, oh, that's our beloved transient, our community member. And he's like, okay, well, what do you want to do with the wallet? And he's communicating with this woman. Well, apparently they'd already, they being a couple of members of the community, have already reported Warren missing because he didn't show up for work, which was very highly unusual for him. And he wasn't showing up to his regular haunts around town, like the bookstore and places like that. So it's a little suspicious, but again, these parents are kind of just blowing it off. And I will say, I'll just put this in here now because I think we're kind of getting the hint of what's going on here, right? Brian's parents have found some peculiar things in his room and in his vehicle prior to this. Things like a shovel and zip ties and a hammer and a giant butcher knife.
He had a hit kit, just like what's his face?
The BTK killer. He had a hit
Rader,
kit.
He had a hit kit. This kid had a hit kit too.
And when his parents found it, they said, okay.
No hit kits.
Well, here's what they did. They said, Brian, now, we are your parents and we love you. And we know it's really, really difficult to resist the urges to kill people. Okay. But it's just not the right thing to do. So here's our ultimatum. You either throw away your hit kit or we're going to call the police.
Which, by the way, possession of those implements would not have been a crime. So nothing would have come of that.
The fact that that his parents were suspicious enough that he was going to do something like violent and didn't do anything about it.
You know what I would have done?
Bad things about that.
I would have accidentally like, oh, sorry, I accidentally threw away your murder utensils. Here's an eviction notice, by the way. You need to get out of here. And we're going on vacation. So when we get back, we're going to have a police clear the dwelling. And we never want to see your ass ever again.
So that coupled with this new thing that's going on where they're like, oh, there might be blood on the back of your vehicle and you have some guy's wallet in your car. His parents are rightfully very suspicious. So on the morning of March 1st, Brian goes to
day.
the next day. Dun dun.
It was literally the next day after the boat incident.
It was. It was the next day. So he died instantly. The next day.
Died instantly.
That's a
meanwhile,
quote
the next day.
Yeah, that's a Hot Rod quote, and it's one of my favorite movies. Anyway, so they're getting increasingly more suspicious of Brian and this activity. So they take it upon themselves, or at least his mother takes it upon herself, to kind of snoop through his room, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, most of the time this doesn't pay off, but in much less bizarre ways. Normally, you don't really want to know what your 19-year-old son is up to. And it's, you know, you're finally going to see him as a man or whatever. You're going to have to deal with that. Maybe you've been dealing with that since he was, you know, 13, 14, 15, whatever. But boy, is she about to get more than she bargained for. Do we want to just go straight to the 911 call?
Yep, let's do it.
From here on out, like, you and I could just nap. We don't even have to do anything. I'll go ahead and play it.
All right, good night.
Because it looks like it's all ear.
Is it bloody or does it, like, anything like that?
Just to be clear, she has just dialed 911 because she has just found a fucking human head. She's telling the 911 dispatcher this, and I know a little bit about this. And 911 dispatchers are going to be a little doubtful that you have just found a human head. One time, I took a 911 call about someone finding a foot. I treated it very respectfully. I said, I believe you that you are now in possession of a human foot. I sent out the police. I sent out a helicopter, the whole thing. I went off to the state lab. We were thinking homicide because most people don't just not have a foot and not report it. That's a very reportable thing. If you think about it, like a car accident over $1,000 is reportable. Loss of foot, usually reportable. Hospitals, you know, usually someone coming up with a stump, you know, may not be reported to the police. But anyway, it turned out to be a mushroom. Anyway.
Do I not take a picture and send it to you?
What's the address? Is your son there now?
He just pulled up. We wanted to make sure he was here before we called.
How old is he?
I don't know if you heard that, but he's trying to say, like, well, is it bloody? Like, how do you know it's a human head? Because he's really hoping she's misidentified it. Because the odds are of a 911 dispatcher taking a call for a found human head are pretty much infinitesimal.
Yes.
So it's not that he doesn't care, but he's like, you know, how could you be sure this is a human head? You know, was it in a box? You know, what's in the box? And
what's in the box?
She gets real snarky right away. Do I have to take a picture? I send it to you? can you just come over here? And it's what happens to all 911 dispatchers. Well, you just send somebody. Ugh. I wanted to, if I'd taken this call, I'd be like, lady, that head ain't getting any deader. Will you please calm the fuck down? I'm not allowed to say that. But anyway, so they'll go through the rest of the 911 call with a little bit, gathering some more information to help the cops know what the fuck is going on. Kendra, any thoughts on the 911 call?
I was irritated listening to it because
you hate dispatchers as a cop, yeah.
No, coming from a law enforcement background, I do get irritated with callers because they don't understand why people are asking certain questions. Same thing, same reason as why people get mad when detectives ask certain things. It's like they're asking things for a reason because they're professionals. Please just answer the question.
However, when road deputies ask things, it's because they didn't fucking listen when I already told them that. Back to the call.
That's fair.
19. He's had a little bit of a fascination with the morbid, but he was channeling it, I thought, into becoming a crime scene investigator, but not so much.
Do you think he's going to be cooperative with us?
I don't know. I don't think he'll be violent. Okay. Just came back from his friend's house.
Does he have any weapons in his room, or do you guys have any in the house?
I don't know. I think that he has a shotgun, but we can certainly remove it immediately before he gets in this room. He's out by the car now, so.
Is the bag still in the closet?
No, it's in my kitchen sink. And there's a secondary bag that I have not opened. It's currently covered with a towel.
And there's a second bag?
Yeah, there's a second bag that I don't know what's in it. I didn't open it.
I'm sorry. Did he take the second bag out of the closet?
I took the second bag out of the closet and put it in the sink.
Where's Brian now?
I think he's still out front.
And you're in the backyard now?
I am, yes, because I don't want him to hear me.
So she gets over pretty quick because she at one point makes a pretty like sarcastic comment. She goes, you know, he had a fascination with the morbid, you know, kind of one of those Hot Topic type kids.
We just thought he would
go full Dexter and just channel it for good. But she's like, but I guess not. I guess he's a fucking murderer with a fucking head in his closet.
I also love how the dispatcher, like when she lowers her tone, he's like, is he in the house? Like he like gets his tone is lower.
That's a sympathetic nervous system thing. Don't rag on the dispatcher.
I'm not ragging on him. I think it's cute. Like, why are we whispering? I don't know. Anyway, I thought it was funny.
Well, it's a conspiratorial tone. Like, you know, when people whisper, like, that's how we control people. When people start yelling at us, I'm just like, ma'am, 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 ma'am. And then they have to shut the fuck up in order to hear me. But then they realize that they don't want to hear me anyway. And then they're just like, are you there? Are you sending a real hero or what? You know, that's usually how it goes. So. All right. You ready for some body cam?
Yeah, so now we're going to go, if you're watching, this is a treat. If you're not watching, you can still hear the audio. But at this point, we've now transitioned to body cam, and this is where the officers arrive, and they're now going to be speaking to Brian Jr., who's out in the driveway waiting for them, essentially. I'm pretty sure his dad told him, yeah, like, you need to cooperate because they're coming.
Dad told him the cops are coming. I'll put a link in the show notes that you can click on the YouTube, because honestly, watching this guy in the arrest portion, the interrogation portion, you have absolutely got to see this guy.
You have to.
So we're going to go to body cam footage now. We'll do our best to describe to you what happens as it's happening, listener. But you're really making yourself into a chump if you don't watch the show. Here we go. This is body cam footage from the deputy who's first on scene.
What's going on, man?
Not much. Cooperate. I am going to cooperate.
Okay, so parents have some concerns of some stuff they may have found in your room?
Yeah, I believe so.
And what would it be?
A human head and hands.
So, the deputy walks up. Very congenial. He says, so your parents are concerned about some stuff in your closet. Normally this, the kid would say, I got some porno in there. I got a gun in there. He says, a human head and hands. Like, he's just like, oh,
and the way he said it, he's so, a human head and hands.
And the way he turns his head. Do you mind if I replay it? I'm going to try to replay it.
Yeah.
And for those not watching, for the stinger, I put in a little music there to make it a little bit more dramatic. And it says on our screen, new achievement unlocked, probable cause. But
that made me laugh.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to try not to back up too far. It's very, very hard not to do. Here we go.
What's going on, man?
Not much. Cooperate. I am going to cooperate.
Okay. So parents have some concerns of some stuff they may have found in your room?
Yeah, I believe so.
And what would it be?
A human head and hands.
Like, for real human head and hands?
Yeah. Son? That fellow who went missing recently.
Which fellow was that?
Warren Brown.
Warren Brown? When did he go missing?
The night of the 27th.
Okay, and how did you end up with him?
I murdered him.
With what?
Okay.
Fastest, so blunt.
Fastest investigation in I think it's Mesa County history, whatever it is. I don't care what county it is. But the cop walks up and goes, yeah, your mom and dad found something. What's going on? He goes, I killed him. Like, we're just,
how did you end up with him? I murdered him. Well,
honestly, the cop's like, damn it. I had an electric chair in the back, but I just dropped it off. The perfect situation for this.
It's, you know, honestly, I mean? It's too... This is too easy. I would be a little disappointed. Like, I'd want to do some more digging and feel like I actually did something a little. Like, this guy just flat out was like, I murdered him. He's in my closet. The end.
The cop should have been like, you realize this normally takes 60 minutes with commercials, right? Like, don't
slow down.
It's over. You know, it's done. This is the fastest game in true crime, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We will be catching you back here next week. No, we actually got a whole bunch of more shit, but I also like how the cop says, like, a for real head.
I know. Well, he probably went there with the same thought, like what you were saying earlier, where he's like, this isn't a human head. It's this just is so some kid.
It's like, just so fucking unbelievable. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. It's unbelievable.
And so, you know,
his demeanor and reaction to it makes it even more unbelievable.
We also need to acknowledge somebody, because you'll see their logo bouncing around the screen like it's a DVD player waiting for you to come back with your popcorn. Explore With Us did an excellent job putting this together. If you want to check out their YouTube channel, they broke this case down in intimate detail that puts, frankly, you and me to shame. But what we bring to this presentation is jokes about salty, vinegary coffee. So we have made this instructional as well, which is why we are able to use this without violating copyright. We are instructing.
We're sweeping the nation. And I think that, honestly, Zaps needs to collaborate with us and make a voodoo chip flavored coffee and K-cups.
I'm just going to come up with something and send it out to you. And we'll talk about how people can send you things at the end of the show. But let's get back to this fucking Kohi investigation. What do you
say? All right, let's do it.
And just wave at me if you want me to stop it at some point, because I can still see you. Let's go.
A knife.
Why would you have done that?
I've always wondered what murder felt like.
Do you have anything on you he's going to cut, poke, hurt, stick me anything without reaching for nothing? Don't reach for nothing.
My phone and my wallet. That's okay. It.
Well, I'm going to have you face that way. Put your hands on top of your head for me real quick. I just want to make sure you interlace your fingers for me real quick, all right? I'm going to have you walk over here. You're going to sit in the back of my partner's patrol car for a minute, okay? Not yet.
Okay.
Just sit back there and hang out for me, okay? Can you walk me inside, please?
So he said, I always wanted to know what murder felt like. It's just like, God sakes, you know, he's just such a fucking wank. So mom's out here sitting in the front lawn crying. Yeah, she did just find a human head. But her husband, Brian Sr., is going to come over and sit next to her. The cop, of course, you know, despite having every reason to believe that there's a human head in there, still really needs someone to, you know, make the introduction into the home, have someone give them permission to go inside. So the cop's going to go in there. So, yes, I mean, going by the book here, we want to make sure that the head and whatever else is in there is not going to get thrown out for not having a warrant. That would be the most ridiculous situation ever. So make sure you're getting make sure you're being allowed to go inside the domicile, that the expectation of privacy is waived, and that, you know,
he was thinking ahead.
Oh, yes. And I was glad that when he patted him down, he found Brian Kohi Jr. was unarmed.
Unhand me, sir.
Later, you'll find out that the guy was dismembered entirely. So that joke will make more. You'll laugh later. You'll think back on it and laugh.
You'll laugh retroactively at this.
Retroactively. When you hear him saying, like, I ripped him asunder limb from limb at the joints like a turkey, you will start laughing wildly because you will remember what I said. So let's keep going. This show's about to be at 2 hours long, so let's get going.
No, it isn't. Let's go.
Let's back to it.
Okay. Let me do it. You go inside.
Let's stay out here with me for a minute.
Sit down. Come on, sit down, baby.
Can I go in there and verify here first?
Oh, yeah, please. Yeah. We haven't seen it. Yeah, we haven't looked at it. It's under the towel in the sink.
Okay.
Annie, stay with your mother. Give her a...
Just make sure that guy goes in the car first.
I have to say, yeah, you can go in the sink, right?
Okay.
Right there. No, yeah. You can house is empty.
Okay.
Had a bad feeling about what happened this weekend.
Okay.
She said there's a bag in his closet, and she opened it up, and she called me and said, get over here right now. I covered it with the towel.
Okay.
I didn't want him to see it because we didn't want him to run. I don't want to look at it.
Yep.
Yep, a real live fucking human head in the sink.
That's it.
This street cop straps on some nitrile gloves, follows the dad inside. The dad's just like, you know, she's been upset all weekend because of everything that happened with the Ford going in the water. And now we've got a fucking human head in her sink. You know, it's like, you know, we got no money. We got no jobs. Our transients' heads are falling off. Totally unacceptable situation here in the Kohi home. So so the cop has wisely gone inside, verified that indeed this is at least an extension of a crime scene. There's some significant evidence here, which means everybody needs to get the fuck out of here. He drops the towel, immediately takes off the gloves, you know, because he's just been given lifelong nightmare fuel seeing this, hacked off eyeless, transient, homeless man, unsheltered man's head in the sink here. Traumatizing to that officer, just in full fairness. Kendra, go ahead.
Well, and you mentioned getting everyone out of the house, and I just want to make a side note that Terry owns a daycare business that she runs out of her
home. Oh, I forgot. This is a daycare. There were kids in this house.
Hey, thank you for stealing my line. Yes, there were children in this house. There were children when she discovered this head, and she had to call all of the parents to come hurry up and get their kids.
And the parents
before she called law enforcement.
The parents are all like, is something wrong? And she goes, no, everything's fine. Everything's fine. All the kids are fine. I found a human head here. not a good daycare center. Come pick up.
The children are safe. It's okay.
So they all come pick up the kids. I can't imagine what she said. Like, oh, we're having a family emergency.
Wasn't the children's heads?
She comes, the kids, you know, kids all get picked up. And I can't imagine what she said. Did she say, oh, it's a family emergency? Did she say, Brian's having an episode again, how do you sweep over this? Because obviously everyone's going to find out. Everyone obviously knows. And there's parents out there that are like, oh my gosh, my kid was in this daycare with this Brian Coey Jr. And when there was a human head in his room. Again, the podcast is on the verge of becoming a 3-hour ordeal. We have to keep this shorter than Avengers Endgame movie. So please, let's keep going.
Go.
Just sit back there and hang out with me, okay?
How are you?
I'm good, sir. How are you? You said your name's Brian?
Yeah. I'm not feeling too well.
You're not feeling too well?
All right. No, these past days, I've been very, very anxious.
That's understandable. So what we're going to have you do here is I'm just going to have you sit in the back here, okay?
Uh-huh.
I'm going to turn on the air for you in a second. That way you're not too hot. Are you a hot-blooded or cold-blooded kind of guy?
I am very cold-blooded. I prefer cold.
Whoops. Very cold-blooded. Whoops. What you call a Freudian slip.
That was a super detective question that she asked there.
Yeah, she's this lady right here, this sheriff's deputy. I'm not even making a joke. He's about to say several weird things in front of her. And now that he's in a custodial situation, she is very smart to A, not Mirandize him, because then if he is smart at all, he will shut up, and B, not ask questions. It's a huge misnomer to think that when you arrest someone, cuffs have got to go on. First of all, you can see they did not place him in handcuffs. That immediately they Mirandize him, they warn him anything they say can and will be used against him. A very smart cop is going to be like, hey, why don't you just get in my car? And then let the silence take over. A lot of suspects and people are going to just want to start talking about what's going on. He's saying, I've been very anxious for the past week. He already told a cop in the driveway, I have a human head and hands in there. He's only going to make statements against interest at this point. He told his parents he would fully cooperate. This deputy is a damn good deputy to just let him say whatever, get it on body cam, get it on the dash cam inside the car, ask him nothing, say nothing.
Silence. Silence is sorry, go ahead, John.
I just wanted to say it can all still be used against him in a court of law because it's a statement against interest. We don't have to Mirandize someone as soon as they're arrested, Kendra.
That's correct. And that's something that people don't understand. Miranda rights is something that we could cover in another episode, because that's something that people don't understand either. And it irritates the piss out of me. You didn't Mirandize me. Like, I don't fucking have to. Anyway, silence is a tactic in and of itself, like you were saying, because people, especially, will find out very shortly that Brian is very proud of his deed that he's done. He's excited about it. And people like that want to tell everyone about it. It's an accomplishment to them. It's like if we graduated college or bought a house, like we want to tell people about it. So sitting in silence is very, very good tactic for people like this, especially obviously she doesn't know that he's this kind of person, but she's very, very smart. And you'll see, like, he says things and she doesn't even respond. She just is dead silent because people like that feel like they need to fill the space, and they want approval from the person they're talking to. So they'll keep talking to coax out some sort of approval or some sort of statement or validation. So it's a good tactic to just be quiet and let them fill the space with their own utterances.
I think a lot of that is going to go on. And also, just for the listener, like I said, they're being very polite to him. He's being very polite back. No handcuffs are on. This is all going to be very important later in the show when I'm going to say something very funny. So just pay attention to that.
Onward.
Well, no, actually, sorry. Hot blood.
So you prefer the cold. Okay, fantastic. All right. So hop in here. I know you're tall, so it's a little bit of a tight squeeze. But like I said, I'll get that air on for you.
Sorry about that.
All right.
Injunction's been quite violent lately.
All right, Brian. We're headed to the sheriff's office, and your family's going to go with us, okay?
It's under this bridge.
So as he is getting in the car, he says, Grand Junction has been quite violent lately. You know, like, okay. And as they're driving along, he says, it was right under this bridge. She says nothing, Kendra.
I was just going to say, he says it's right under this bridge. They're passing under the bridge that Warren Brown was sleeping under the night that he was murdered by Brian Cohey.
They always return to the scene of the crime. Sometimes involuntarily. Yes. Anyway, and keep going.
Jeff. Well, I also want to say, I think it's funny that he was like, sorry about that. Like, sorry about murdering someone.
You know what?
I just think
I'll get to it all in time. We got plenty to say. Let's keep going. We're getting out of the station here.
Thank you.
No problem, sir. So walk with me. We're going to walk right this way, okay?
You're fine with me not being in cuffs.
I'm fine with you not being in cuffs.
Okay, thank you.
How did you get...
So now they're inside interrogation. I just wanted to mention again, they're just bringing them aside. First of all, threat assessment, Kendra. You're a bit of a badass. You know, you used to drag people around by the hair and spit into their open mouths. It's not just that, you know, he's being cooperative, but you're also not afraid of this goober, are you, as a cop?
No, I mean, and you never have the mindset of, like, this guy's not a problem, because you never really know. But, this guy's not a threat, an immediate threat to your safety, no.
Yes, and I will, again, come back to that later. So we're just going to go right into interrogation, and Kendra, here's where we're going to do the whole wave at me to make it stop thing, okay?
Okay.
So they're going inside again.
Right this way, okay?
You're fine with me not being in cuffs.
I'm fine with you not being in cuffs.
Okay, thank you.
And how did you get here?
I murdered someone.
Okay. So start back at the beginning and go slow and tell me as many details as you can remember.
So, because, I mean, Murray going to jail for 15 years, probably.
I have no idea.
Because
we're at the beginning.
It's murder. I mean, I'm going to jail for 20, probably. But, so I figured I'd fight it.
Okay. So what's important to me is to learn as much about you and what you did and as I can.
Well,
as many details as you can give me, the better.
Let's see. Yeah, it was the night of February 27th. It was a full moon. And I figured, I can see so well, why not try it out? I am in a bad state of mind at that time. I have major depressive disorder, so I am not thinking something positively.
Okay.
And I'm cruising around for an hour, hour and a half. So I fill up on gas halfway through, and I'm eventually driving underneath the bridge near the sheriff's office. I'm bad with speaking. I'm bad with words. I'm just... Yeah. By the way, I'm a habitual shaker. I have a question.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Stop for a second.
You said people who have committed...
Oh, what do you got, Kendra?
A couple of things that he said, and I don't think, by the way, we need to break down the whole interrogation, but just a couple things, like him saying, I'll probably go away for 15 years, 20 probably, or him saying, I'm a habitual shaker. He has done a lot of research on
a lot
forensics and interrogations and murder and things like that. He's done a lot of research, and what he's doing, trying to do, is show his... He's trying to throw them off by saying, I'm a habitual shaker, because he knows that those are some clues that investigators look for to indicate deception or guilt or whatever. So he's getting ahead of those things. And also the fact he's all throughout this interrogation, which as John said, you could go watch it. It's very, it's fascinating. He's yucking it up the whole time. He's very arrogant. He thinks it's funny. He thinks it's cool that he murdered somebody. It's something he's always wanted to do. But I think he's trying to show his prowess and maybe get in the investigators' heads, which he doesn't accomplish because these are very professional investigators. But
also he thinks
he's getting in their heads by showing his knowledge of the system.
I think he wants their approval. This is a kid who, you know, we said he wanted to become a crime scene investigator, and he's had an interest in this field for a long time. He views this as his time to have an audience with these real live detectives. He's going to explain everything that happened to him. He even diagrams things on the whiteboard behind him at one point. But I think him getting to tell his own personal, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer story is the thrill of a lifetime for him.
Oh yeah.
I think he used to actually, this was something that was found in one of his notebooks at school, but he used to have little, would call them dossiers if they were individual folders, but little breakdowns of every famous serial killer that he loved, Zodiac, Jeffrey Dahmer, and all these guys. And he typified them, you know, organized serial killer, unorganized serial killer, number of victims, number of injured, had all the, how these statistics on them, like it was the back of a football card or something, like how many rushing yards did Jeffrey Dahmer have in his rookie season? You know, how many people did he kill? The exact same type of thing. He didn't have a little picture glued on there, but he loved serial killers. At one point, somebody called him Jeffrey Dahmer. He was sort of obsessed with these things.
He dressed up as Jeffrey Dahmer for Halloween.
He did. And I think that, you know, when you're a loser and you're not good academically, you can't fit in with the nerds and you're not fitting in with anyone else, you kind of embrace not fitting in. How do I know this? I've never fucking fit in. I remember my sister telling me at age 5 that, like, I was a weirdo. And I remember deciding right then and there that I didn't. My sister was very popular with people, and I'm like, I will never be like her, and I don't want to be. I don't want to be somebody that fits in with groups of people and has a lot of friends. I decided very, very, very young. But it gets harder when you are 13, 14, and you're, you know, the whole social group acceptance thing comes in. But once you're already rejected, you just lean into that, and then you sort of get a weird kind of pride out of however weird you are, and you get a thrill from the bizarre reactions that you get, and you enjoy provoking people with strange behavior. And, you know, I did some things like that. I still to this day, you know, I will do that. Like, case in point, at the start of the podcast, you asked me how I am. I said, terrible. Thanks for asking, because I like being the weird guy. What's different is that I also get in this podcast and rant about how much I hate people who kill people for fun. So
sure.
I'm not a direct, you know, Brian Cohey corollary, but I think that I kind of get him on some level, and that he likes to be weird, and he's leaned into it really hard. And that everything that has to do with the macabre, he's made that part of his identity, because he's been so rejected by everyone else. He's establishing this singular thing that's just for him, that's all for himself. Right. And now he's in a position where he can tell these people, these two detectives, all about it, and he gets to be the star of the show. And he's under the misappropriation that he's going away for 15 or 20 years. That's not what's going to happen to him. But he thinks that he's going to lose out on a little bit of time. He's going to get paroled at some point and then just go on his merry way. That's not what's going to happen. I do want to hear more of an interrogation, if you're okay with that, Kendra. All right.
Let's keep going. Crimes like me, do we stay in this county jail or are we moved?
It all depends on what the judge says. So we were at the bridge.
Yes, I was at the bridge. I was cruising. There was a road underneath, right? Uh-huh. Under the overpass, and I was driving along, and I see a shape here on the railway tracks. So I'm like, oh, interesting. So I go up, and as I'm looking, I see a large thing wrapped in a canvas.
Okay.
And I'm like, that's a homeless person. So I grab my knife, I put on 3 layers of gloves, because plastic gloves can betray their users because they're so thin, the vinyl gloves, by imprinting your fingerprints through. So I put on 2, 3 on one hand, I took the knife, I pulled back the canvas, and I stabbed his neck.
Okay.
He was panicking at first in his old man voice. He was in his 50s. I know why I call an old man. He was saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why? Ah. And I just kept on stabbing his neck. I was Is it okay if I do a demonstration?
Oh, yeah.
This is him. I was.
He is now on the floor. Mm-hmm. Doing a full-on demonstration, which, by the way, a jury is going to eat this up. And this investigator's like being handed like the easiest interrogation of his life. He's like, all I have to do is just ask. And he says, I don't have to try to like wait this guy out. I don't have to break him down. This kid's willing to get on the floor and like demonstrate how he murdered this guy. And honestly, I wonder what this investigator thought leaving the room when he's just like, he probably felt tired and dirty being exposed to this level of evil, because that's what this guy ultimately is. You can say whatever you want about his personality or his rejection stuff or being on the spectrum or not taking his meds. Ultimately, like we are dealing with someone here who feels nothing about what he did to the point where he smiles and laughs about it. Kendra, anything before we move on?
I'm looking at it from, I don't want to say that, like, trying to be careful how I word this. When I research these cases and I read, I've been, like a lot of people who are watching, I'm sure, I've been into true crime for a really long time. I experienced true crime as a law enforcement officer, dealt with a lot of different types of people. And I don't really get so shocked and awed anymore by the evil. So when I watch these things, I'm looking at it from a court perspective. And the things that stand out to me about it is just the absolute, like you said, how easy this case is. These investigators do a really good job at recognizing the kind of, they read him immediately. They recognize the kind of person he is. And they know exactly what he wants, which is to be approval, to be validated, to be praised for what he did, because he's proud of himself and he thinks he's smarter than everybody. So they do a really good job at providing that validation. At one point, one of the investigators, he talks about a 3-day rule or a 3 rule in decomp. And he's like, isn't that kind of how it works? And she's like, yeah, basically, yeah, you know your stuff. And he sits back with a smile on his face, and that makes him comfortable enough to continue showing how he murdered somebody. He goes on to tell them, I don't know how much of the interview you want to play, so I'm not trying to spoil it, but he goes on to tell them his foiled plan that I spoke about earlier with the shovel and the zip ties. He was going to go get a prostitute and kill her. He's done a lot of research. He says that he took measures. Like he says, I took measures to make sure that I didn't get caught. So what they're doing is they're building the premeditation aspect of it so they can do the first degree murder. They're allowing
proving him that he knows the difference between right and wrong. Right.
Yeah. Because he's going to inevitably plead insanity. Cause that's what a good defense would do in this case. Cause he totally backed himself into a corner. I feel bad for the defense team. So not to ramble too much, but that's what I'm looking at when I watch those interviews, because the evil side of it, I'm not trying to sound like a tough ass. I'm just saying, I just accept the fact that there's fucking evil people in the world. So it doesn't shock me as much, but this guy, what shocks me about this guy is he's just such an idiot. Well, and he's so pompous and he thinks that he's smarter than everybody.
He's stupid, but I think he's finally getting validation that he has never gotten from anyone else. Like at one point, he says this on two occasions. He says, I'm bad with words. And a detective knows exactly how to launch him. She says, I think you're actually very, very articulate. And he goes, oh, really? Thank you. And he likes getting that praise. And I don't think he's getting it at home, but also I think he's just insecure as a person and he's finally being appreciated for what he really is. And I think he feels good about it. I'll keep playing it for a little while longer. I do have about, 7 minutes left.
Okay.
It's only about halfway through. We'll keep going for a little while longer.
Okay.
Traveled on top of him like this.
Okay.
And he couldn't fight back. It was actually surprisingly easy. I was barely breaking the sweat. I thought, oh, this guy, he's going to be tough. But no, it was actually surprisingly easy. And during the time, I was growling and making animalistic noises. Destroyed his eyes by stabbing them.
Okay.
And then I cut off his hands. I put those in plastic Ziploc bags. And then I cut off his right arm at this joint and at this joint. And then at this arm, I tried cutting it here, and then I tried cutting it here. But what happened was I accidentally broke his bone. This one, it was poking out. And so I left that one here partially cut, dismembered here, bone sticking out. And then I left his body there. And then I took the head, put it in a leftover pizza box from the dinner a few nights ago. And then I took the hands, put them in the back, drove home, hid the hands and head in my room, cleaned the knife, threw away the garbage with his blood on it, and then put the blood stained, wasn't stained, it had splatters on it. I put it in the dish, in the washing machine.
What did you put in there?
I put the outfit I murdered him in.
Did you wear it? Or?
Yeah, I was wearing it.
Okay.
In a washing machine, put it on high speed so it would effectively remove the blood. Washed it twice.
Back up just so I don't lose track of where my mind is. So you cut him open, did you cut his arms off, his hands off, all that before you went home?
Yeah, before I went home, I tossed the arm bits around. Like I took the right arm bit, threw it out,
okay.
Took the left arm bit, threw it out.
So it's somewhere around that bridge?
Yeah, but look in a, because I know crime scenes can be a very wide area.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to look in a 10-foot area. I hope I'm being cooperative.
Oh, you're doing great. So you could have just walked over here.
I could have.
No, you just did it again.
Trying to deceive law.
So that's north, and you threw. What all did you throw while you were there? I mean, how many pieces am I looking for?
There are two pieces of arm. This section and this section.
Okay.
In this general area. I couldn't tell you where they are.
Did he see you?
No, he was not woken up until I pulled the sheets back.
I know this will be really fast. You pulled the sheets back.
And
before you stabbed him, did he see you?
No. And I pulled the sheets back. I get on him. Oh. Like I need. And then stab him. And he wakes up. He's, what are you doing? What are you doing? Okay. Yeah.
And I think you stabbed him anywhere besides, but I know you said the neck a lot.
So now we have actually a second version of the story. We laughed earlier when he says, I was making animal sounds. Arr, 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 you know, those are John's murder sounds. But now his account of stabbing Warren Brown to death, Warren Brown became conscious at some point and fought back feebly, but it was asking, why are you doing this? And in my view, I don't think this happened very fast. If someone's, instead of just screaming, ah, or holy fuck, or what the fuck, or whatever, or
yeah.
Like, fuck you, saying, why are you doing this? I'm a little worried that by asking that question, if he did, I'm worried that Warren Brown suffered. Because
yeah.
That's a question that's somewhat ponderous, right? Why are you doing this? When most people are surprised when they're asleep, when something bad's happening to them. I mean, I know this, like, I mean, you know, how did my mom discipline me? You know, when I wasn't doing the dishes, when I was arguing with my sisters, my mom didn't yell at me. She didn't scream at me. She waited until I was asleep. Then she would come in and pummel me, you know, and I would always be like, ah, mom, what are you doing? You know, and, you know, but whenever I would question my mom, like, why are you this way? Why is the family this way? It was always very ponderous. And it was while I was suffering. So I just worry that Warren Brown here might have been suffering if indeed the second account of what happened to him in his last moments is true.
Yeah. He also goes on, he'll probably say in a second, he gave him a, what he called a Glasgow smile or like the Joker cut across his face. Like he wasn't just in a frenzy. I don't believe he was just in a frenzy stabbing him in the heat of the moment. Like he's trying
yeah.
to say,
no.
I think he took pleasure in it. Cause his first plan to murder a prostitute when he got foiled by his parents, he says in this interview, he wanted to subdue them, tie them up and torture them. So he wasn't like just out and about, you know, his mind wasn't just like on a whim going to,
it wasn't a berserker rage. He didn't see white and just, you know, fly into a fury. I think this was much, much more calculated.
Right. Right. I think so too. Well, it was calculated. He'd been looking for a
well, I just mean, I mean the actual final act of murder. Yeah, of course, the whole stalking his prey thing was very deliberate. But I think even the final moments, and when you go back and you look at some of the way that he killed the cat, it was very much in a manner similar to this with decapitation and dismemberment.
Right.
I think that I think that he, I think it's entire, you know, we would have to look at a lot of evidence, which was lost because he was dismembered and parts of him were lost in the river when he backed up his Ford 500 into the river to try to like float the evidence away.
Right.
But there would have been things that we would have been able to tell about post-mortem and paramortem injuries. I worry that some of this dismemberment might have happened while Warren Brown was alive. And I don't say that to worry the audience or like rob you of your sleep, but why else would Warren Barnes, why would he utter the phrase, why are you doing this? Unless he was being confronted with the reality of the evil which was upon him, you know.
And also he broke one of his bones and Brian's very upset about this because it foiled his perfect, he thought he was going to do it perfectly because he's done so much research on it. And the way that he says that he said that it was a compound fracture where it was poking out of his skin. And to me, it's like, you don't just accidentally do that. It takes a lot it was his humerus. So, I mean, it wasn't like it was a small little bone. He compound fractured the guy's humerus. And that I feel like that takes a little bit of a push and pull to do that in that moment. So I don't, you know, I'm not a medical examiner, but.
There was one killer. I'd have to look up his name, but we covered his case last year. But there was this guy that used to get sexual gratification from breaking bones.
Yeah.
And he kept people. He kept this kid hidden away, yes, like in a trap house, and just repeatedly broke his bones over the course of a weekend. And he got sexual gratification from this. An aspect of Brian Cohey's sexual gratification. They think that he's possibly reliving this, and that's why he's enjoying it so much, is he's getting titillated by this. At no point are we given any sort of gruesome detail, like, you know, that he becomes engorged in the thrill of the moment. But when they confront him about all the killers who were sexual sadists, he says, oh, no, that didn't do anything for me sexually.
Right.
But, you know, you really have to wonder, because there's a pathology there that he's fitting into that's very much like these guys. And the joy that he takes in it almost does seem to be, like I said, rather, you know, I can't think of a better word, just titillating. Titillating.
I hate that word. I hate that.
Do you like scintillating better, or do you just hate tit? Which word do you hate?
I don't want to say it, but I don't like scintillated is fine. But
you don't like titillating?
No, stop saying it.
Well, you know, it actually has nothing to do with the word that you're thinking of. It's just a different word. But
it's just the sound of it. I don't like the repeating T's. It makes me grossed out. But I take a lot of stock in his original plan personally to get some of the psychology behind this guy, in my opinion. I'm not a psychologist. I'm certainly not a forensic psychologist or any sort of detective, but he had an elaborate plan, means to do so. He was going to carry it out where he was going to lure a prostitute. And I'm sorry, but I just don't think that there isn't a sexual side to that.
Well, here's another person that he falls in the vein of. He said at one point when he was a younger person, he found some sort of rodent. I don't know if it was a squirrel or something similar to that, but he actually tried to take the skin and make leather out of that. Who does that remind you of?
Yeah.
Ed Gein.
Ed Gein. And he's got a couple of people. He's got Ed Gein, Jeffrey Dahmer,
the driving around looking for people, a little bit 44 caliber killer,
and BTK. Ed Kemper, he's an Ed Kemper fan too. So I mean, there's that. He kind of looks like Ed Kemper, in my opinion.
He does. He's tall and kind of rotund. He has a lot of that. And Ed Kemper, unless I'm confusing, Ed Kemper was very, very genial and cooperative with police.
He loved law enforcement. He wanted to be a law enforcement officer. All of his friends were cops.
Ed Gein was a former cop as well. But when John Douglas, who famously wrote Mindhunter, interviewed Ed Kemper, he said that, you know, that Ed Kemper was, you know, just downright friendly to him. And this reminds me of that. And it's just amazing, because this guy could have very well been the next Ed Kemper if he hadn't had his fucking mom snooping around in his bedroom. You know what I mean? If he had moved out at age 18, he might have gone on to do a lot more harm. And I think this was an Ed Kemper BTK type guy that we managed to nip in the bud.
Sport.
But let's keep listening for more titillating tidbits and for commentary on those.
Yeah, because we got to wrap this up soon, or else it's going to be a Marvel movie.
Yes, plus you need to go to sleep. Let's keep going. Back to the interview.
How many times do you think? Did you count?
No. I was going until he stopped.
Okay, how many? Just your best idea how many times?
30 or 40.
Okay. You said the neck. Besides cutting his arms off.
Well, actually, it was a general assault. I was mainly targeting his neck because that's the most vulnerable area. I was stabbing his head anywhere in that general area. I stabbed his head multiple times.
How about his chest, his stomach?
His chest, I stabbed once through the ribs.
Did you see that lady come in and then immediately leave?
That was the other investigator. Yeah, she was
She's a pro detective, but I like the idea that she comes in and then she's hearing something. She goes, "Oh, wrong room."
Right hand. It was his right ribs, and I just went. I sliced open his belly, carved up his leg. Not like I made several slices out of his leg.
Why did you do that?
I was just doing everything I thought of at the moment. Then.
Did he say that he sliced him up on his legs?
Yeah.
I bet those are the wounds that happened pre-mortem.
Yeah, probably.
I bet he's telling it in a different order. Let's keep going.
I think he probably disemboweled him too.
He mentioned that specifically. He said that he cut him open across his belly, horizontally, perpendicular against the lane of the line of bilateral symmetry, and that his gut spilled out. He said that he saw his organs, that he was able to identify certain among them, including the liver, which he knew from his advanced study of anatomy and physiology. So he did disembowel him, and I wonder. I hope you're not going with this. I hope that he did that pre-mortem.
That's what I was saying. Was that. I think that he disemboweled him while he was still alive.
That's definitely an occasion in which you would say, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Because it's torture and it's horror, you know.
And that's what he wants to do is torture. He says that was his plan initially, and he showed that he liked to cause people pain, whether it was emotional or physical, through his behaviors in school. His plan to torture a prostitute, and I believe that he tortured Warren as well before he killed him, unfortunately. Yeah,
I believe that as well. And just the fact that we have two accounts of the story means there's some untruth going on here. He's being so open and so cooperative with everything and giving everything we need to convict him beyond the power to appeal.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that he's telling the truth about everything, because I think he's not willing to cop to the torture necessarily. I think if this investigator had been able to walk down that road more slowly, maybe that would have come out eventually. But, he says at some point, he goes, there's no point in trying to deceive the long arm of the law.
Yeah.
Which is such a weird fucking thing to say. It's something I would say, which is weird of me. But,
this guy's a major dork.
Well, see, I am too, but I'm too lazy to kill it. I've said that on the show hundreds of times.
I know. That's why I tell people not to give you energy drinks.
Yeah. I have been abstaining for almost a full week now.
Good.
And just not coincidentally, no one has been killed at my hands at all in that time.
Oh, wonderful.
I gave him a Glasgow smile.
What's that?
A Joker smile.
Why were you doing that?
I suppose it was a frenzy. I was so excited, so rushed up on adrenaline every day. And I paused and he's like, why are you doing this? And I said, I've been wanting to do this for a long time.
Where else did you stab him before he was dead?
Oh, he just asked an important question there. Did you stab him before he was dead? But I wanted to circle back to what he just said.
Yeah.
He said, why are you doing this? The answer is, I've been wanting to do this for a long fucking time. I think he desperately wanted to do all the things he was doing, and I think he savored it.
He's reveling in it.
He's reveling in it right now, just recalling it. But I think during the murder of Warren Barnes, I think he absolutely reveled in that too. And I think that's why Warren had occasion to say, why are you doing this? Because he was alive for a long time. His first account of the story was animal noises and random stabbing. And post-mortem decapitation and dismemberment. But now we're hearing about disemboweling. We're hearing about, stabbing marks to the legs, which if this kid knows anatomy, or just if he's, you know, anybody would know this, but it's like, if you're, you know, if you, as long as you avoid the femoral artery, you can sit there and stab somebody essentially in the meat or in the bone over and over again and cause them a great deal of pain. And if you, and if you get off on that sort of thing, then, you know, that's a great way to do it before, you know, you go for the neck wound or whatever was used to cause the injury, or, you know, right, stabbing him in the torso too, bleeding out until hypovolemia takes over and you pass out. That's also pretty horrifying. But I do believe that torture was definitely an aspect of this. I can't wait to hear the answer to this question. Did you stab him at all before he died? Kendra.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't really have much else to offer on that, because I just don't think that he, I think that he had this plan that he doesn't want to admit to, because I think he does get sexual gratification out of it. And because he murdered a man, I think perhaps he doesn't want to admit that he got off to that.
I think you're right about the sexual gratification. I think that's the aspect of it that might bring him enough shame to where he's not talking about that openly.
Yeah, because his first plan didn't work, and so he went with the second best, which he thought would be someone that no one would miss, and he picked the very wrong transient to do this with.
He picked the beloved Warren Barnes. All right, let's get the answer to the question. If he stabbed him before he died.
Now worry about the head and neck.
Okay. When did you stab him in the chest?
After he perished.
Okay, and how did you know he perished?
He let out a final gasp.
Okay.
And he wasn't fighting later on. He was losing too much energy, blood loss. Okay. And he just finally gasped, and I needed to make sure, peace of mind, so I decapitated him, partially as for the hell of it.
So let's try to go step by step. You said you stabbed him in the neck and the head while he's alive.
Yes, I paused. We had a conversation where he said, why are you doing this? And I said, I felt like doing this for a long time. I continued. He died, deceased, whatever you want to call it. And then I stabbed his ribs, opened up his belly, sliced his leg multiple times.
Okay.
De-robed him, and then decapitated him, removed his hands, his joints.
Did you derobe him before or after you opened
his belly? After I opened his belly.
So you cut through his clothes to open?
No, I lifted up his shirt and just...
Okay. Which way did you go? Like a deer this way or like this way?
No, this way across his
belly. Okay. He was very... You didn't see his heart or anything?
No, he was very thin. I thought about taking out...
What all do you think he saw?
What
did you see?
I saw his liver, his large and small intestine, and that's it. Some of it was yellow. I was thinking about taking out his heart. I was thinking about crushing the ribs and disemboweling him entirely.
Okay. Did you disembowel him at all, or just cut him open?
I cut him open, but his organs spilled out by themselves when I was dumping him.
Did you take any pictures that night?
Yes, but I deleted them.
Okay.
Entirely.
Where did you take pictures?
After I killed him, I took a picture of him, his hands, but I deleted all those because those are evidence.
Okay.
I don't know if you can find them. But
when you say you deleted them entirely, that's an interesting statement. What do you mean by that?
I removed them from my phone, deleted the pictures.
Okay.
I was planning to maybe keep a finger.
Okay. You haven't got that far yet.
No.
Lying finger.
That's small. Not that much space. It won't smell that much.
Makes sense.
You need to keep.
You talked about you were just kind of in a bad space that night.
Okay, so just to bring you up to speed, he said he wanted to keep a finger because it would be convenient for him. He said he deleted his pictures almost completely. They would go to the United States Secret Service, who would dump his phone, and they recovered pictures of the incident, which, you know, just corroborate a lot of what he's saying. I wonder if the pictures would have corroborated a scene of torture. Mm-hmm. That would have been something that would have been very instrumental. I think he ultimately gets charged with desecrating a corpse, so maybe the pictures were not of him in his full exuberance, but the pictures obviously might have told a different story if we had a picture of a wounded Warren.
Go ahead. I thought you were done.
No, I am done. You go ahead.
Oh, okay. Another thing to kind of keep in mind when you're watching stuff like this is they mentioned they're trying to determine a couple of things. One, the big one is premeditation, obviously. And then the other one is the insanity, because they know what's going to happen. They've been down this road before. They know he's going to try to plead insanity. They need to get him to establish that he knew right from wrong. And things like saying, well, I deleted the pictures, or I washed my clothes, or I did XYZ to evade being caught. That's establishing that in the moment, once it was over, he took measures. He recognized, like, this is bad. I need to cover this up because it was wrong. If you don't think that something is wrong, you have no need to cover it up or delete pictures or anything like that. The premeditation side of it, they establish it very, very well. And he also said, there's just so much in this interview.
it's very long.
At one point, what?
It's very long. Keep going.
It is long. He reiterates how much he needs that validation and approval from these guys too. And one of the things that he says that I take note of is when he's like, they're just sitting there. Brian's already admitted to everything. And he goes, I hope I'm being cooperative enough, because he wants to coax that. He doesn't feel like he's getting enough from these detectives. He wants that to wow them. It's just so crazy to watch. This whole interview is insane.
It is. Let's keep going, and we'll get to the end and talk about his sentence, and then we'll talk about his parents, and then we'll have a special bonus segment, Kendra, that I think will make you happy. But let's keep going.
Okay.
It was, yes. Okay. Why were you in a bad state?
I didn't take my medicine, and plus for years I was wondering what murder would feel like, because Ted Bundy and the Zodiac, they all say murder is the best feeling in the world. So I'm like, I'm going to try that. So for some time, I had been wondering when it would happen. I always knew I would be in this building, whether it was as a criminal or a police officer.
He gets to the end, and they ask him, you know, what he felt about this.
Yeah. Although I wasn't breaking a sweat killing the guy, it was quite easy.
Well, did you enjoy it or not enjoy it?
Did I enjoy it? I don't know. Sort of neutral of the whole thing. I didn't enjoy it, but I didn't hate it. If I go back that night, I wouldn't have done it, knowing what it felt like, knowing how this will all turn out. I wouldn't have done it.
What did you think it was going to feel like?
I thought it would be the best feeling in the world.
You said you didn't feel much of anything.
Excitement.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
But other than that, no.
Other than that, he felt nothing at all. Afterwards, when he went to prison, when he was sentenced to life, somebody, I think it was a counselor or something, interviewed him with, you know, looking back on it and what he thought of it. He goes, you know, it sucked. That's a thing that happened. So, you know, it sucked, but kind of an is what it is attitude. And they asked him, what about it sucked? He goes, you know, I miss video games and I miss the internet, you know. He doesn't like being in prison. He feels nothing. He feels no remorse at all. Feels he can't reflect on anything that has to do with what he actually did. He just feels sorry for himself, which is, you know, a little classic narcissism, Kendra.
Yeah, that part irritated me as well. Like he's shown absolutely zero remorse or care. This is something, it's so redundant in these cases with the people that do things like this. The personality type is very obvious. It's apparent. And there's people like, he compares himself to Jeffrey Dahmer a lot, but Jeffrey Dahmer, he's so controversial now because of the Netflix series and stuff like that. However, Jeffrey Dahmer took a lot of responsibility for what he did, and I don't know if he felt remorse, but he recognized that he needed to be put away because he knew that something was wrong with him. I don't think he felt real remorse. I just think that he was intelligent enough to recognize that, oh, I'm fucked up and I need to be away from humans.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say this. He does kind of remind me of Jeffrey Dahmer in that way, because he's very neutral about it. He doesn't have a feeling towards it. He's just like, yeah, I probably wouldn't have done it because it wasn't worth all of this, because it didn't feel that great. But he doesn't feel bad about taking a human life and torturing him to death at all.
No, it feels nothing. I wanted to say this about the parents, because I got a little bit of shades of that in their parents as well. At one point, when they're interviewing the mom and talking about his difficulties at school, she's defensive. I think any mother would say that a child getting in trouble, they see that as a reflection of them and their inherent parenting skills, and any criticism of the child is a criticism of them. So when they're interviewing her, you know, and about how he got these nunchucks off of a kid who brought the weapon to school, and that he traded candy for them or whatever. And they're like, oh, well, you don't care about this other kid. You only care about my son because he's had a history of behavioral problems. Like, yeah, we care about the kid who has behavioral problems, who's now armed. This other kid who might be bringing nunchucks for show and tell, like, that's less dangerous. Like, when your kid has been deemed to possibly be a danger to others and now he has a weapon, that's a problem. When they got the dad in, he goes, you know, what am I supposed to do? I can't work anymore. He and I have the same name. I can't go back to work. Both mom and dad don't care at all about this homeless person whose head he brought home in a pizza box. They care about how it reflects on him. And mom has legitimate complaints, you know, about pretty much, you know, her daycare being ruined for all time. I'm sure both of them had to change their names and move away. But his whole thing is like, I share the same name of him. I'm not going to be able to work. You know, how is that going to affect me? In other words, they should have both been like, how the hell did we raise a murderer who stabs and dismembers people? Maybe they didn't know at that point, but you know, and just points for them. They did immediately take right action in reporting it. They told him to cooperate with police, and he said he would cooperate. Well, gosh, Mom, I'm going to cooperate, which was like a totally Napoleon Dynamite moment for him. but the parents, I got a little bit of that from them, that there might have been something wrong too, which, you know, we're all just apples from our various tree. Did you have any comments on the parents before I move on to the next little bonus segment?
Yeah, I think I can understand a lot of, I like to stay very open. I do actually like to play devil's advocate with myself, because it keeps me from putting myself in an echo chamber or being like, you know, too one track minded with stuff like this, because this is an absolutely horrible, complicated dilemma for these parents, regardless of how shitty they were as parents or irresponsible or whatever. They were put in this position partly by their own actions, mostly by Brian's actions, obviously. The parents did not force him to go out and murder a transient. I'm not saying that, but
they did half-ass try to stop him.
Well, it irritates me a lot that the fact that they were so suspicious of him immediately when the cops saw the blood in the trunk tells me that they knew something was very, very wrong.
That's exactly why she was snooping in his room the next day. She knew
something was wrong. Yes, and they did nothing. They really did nothing, because you can tell that all they did was make excuses for Brian and for his behavior. And they claimed that he had gone to therapy and things like that. But what, and here's the other side of this. And I often think this too, when people put blame on parents, well, what exactly, here's me playing devil's advocate. What exactly are they supposed to do? There's no program for, I think my son might be a murderer. What, I mean, there's really not a lot that you can do, but the fact that they, it just
sounds like a new show on, it sounds like a new show on Hulu. I think my son might be a murderer.
Right. It's, but they knew in their heart of hearts, and Brian's dad even says, like, I kind of like, I'm not really surprised, or I knew, he said something along those lines, but then he turns around and says, Brian's not violent.
He says he's not violent, right? He says he's strange, he's different, but he's not violent. There's a head in your house, sir. You can't make that claim anymore. It's over and done with. I think both of the parents were looking out for themselves a little bit, and I think so too.
I get the vibes that, like, and this is based on absolutely nothing except my own observation, so please take this with a grain of salt, but I get the vibe that dad's a pushover, mom runs the roost. And mom is one of those mothers to boys who doesn't see anything wrong with their boys. Nothing their boys do could ever be wrong, and everything, they're just precious little angels and everyone's out to get them. And that's the vibe I get from this. Now, yes, kudos to her for calling, but she had to physically find a human head in order to actually take action. I'm just throwing that out there.
Every boy's best friend is his mother.
Okay. That's why it's like a Norman Bates. It's like a Bates situation here.
I just did the look. You didn't notice.
I did. Let's
go to my favorite segment of the show, other podcast, Stupidest Takes.
Yay, it's back.
Put him in the car. It's so matter of fact. I don't want to look at this.
And this is the part where it's like I was referring to earlier, where it's kind of frustrating with how cordial they are with him being such a horrific person. But I understand it's their job, and their job is to arrest him. And if they do that easily, by all means, right? Nobody gets hurt. He doesn't attack any officers, whatever. All's well that ends well. But it's just frustrating how they're like, oh, could you come with me and get in the back of the car?
It's like after it's like seeing so many
ass in the car.
Put some handcuffs on
put
him.
Put some fucking handcuffs.
At this point, it's like you don't really know how dangerous he is. Huh? Just walking free-handed, all Neanderthal-like, and just like gets in the back of the car, and they're so friendly to him. Like you just found the severed head and hands of a murder victim in this guy's fucking sink. You are being so friendly.
All right, so this is why it's stupid, because first of all, it doesn't work that way like it does on TV, where you get to Elliot Stabler, you come with me, you filthy son of a bitch, and then Odafin Tutuola's in his face. What kind of criminal likes to touch little boys, you know? And then Munch is like, if you ask me, the government's in on it, you know? Then they just all, you know, start going after him. These cops were all smart. They said, hey, how's it going today? And then he's just like, I have head and hands in my house. And goes, okay, well, we're going to check that out. You get in the car. We're going to get you some air conditioning. We're going to get you some water. We're going to take you down. There's no reason to make it adversarial. He came to the edge of the driveway, said, I'm going to cooperate. Said, there's a head and hands of a guy who disappeared on February 27th. He's with me because I murdered him, because I said that I have always wanted to feel murder. He said every single thing that you really, really needed to know right away. But not only that, but it's like there's no reason to be adversarial, right? If this guy's cooperating with you, the best thing you could do with any suspect is be nice to him, be friendly to him, make him want to talk to you. What you see in Law and Order, honestly, it doesn't even work on Law and Order, because, you know, Mike Logan will sit there, Lenny Briscoe, and they'll argue with them, and they'll be giving them what we used to call the third degree or the ninth degree or the nth degree. I don't remember which degree it was, but they really went to town on him, right?
Yeah.
And it was always like, I ain't say nothing to you, coppa. And it's just like, it doesn't fucking work that way. Police will literally try to be friendly, try to create an affable environment. Like you said, they'll create plenty of, pregnant pauses, open silences if people want to fill that up and talk. They'll be courteous, professional, polite. That's their job. But it ultimately just creates a rapport through which you could influence people's behavior and get them to talk to you. There's no reason to straight out of the gate be adversarial. And the reason why these podcasters react this way, Kendra, is they don't have what you and I have. And you know what that is? Real life experience with murderers. You and I have literally been in the company of murderers. When I worked at the prison one night, we had a homicide. I pulled the guy out of his cell. I rearrested him and put him in another jail cell by himself because I'm a bit of a thinker. And I'm looking right at this guy and I'm like, holy crow, this guy just murdered his cellmate. He's literally a murderer. But you know what, Kendra, and I'm sure you'll agree, it's really not a big deal. You know, you're not scared of the guy. He's not threatening you. He doesn't have a weapon. He's being cooperative. That's just professional discretion and intelligence. And it's not like in the movie where you turn around, put your hands behind your back, you full on felony stop him unless it's necessary. There's no reason to do that. And this guy didn't give him a reason. Kendra, what's your experience being around murderers? Pretty nice people most of the time, right?
Well, yeah, the few times that I've been around people that have murdered someone, it's been a mixed bag, actually, because it's like, you know, I've been around.
You do a lot of gang shit.
It's just, murders like this are very different than, like, I shot somebody over a drug deal and they died, right? But, you know, I've been around a couple of, like, blatant, they just, like, murdered somebody. And for the most part, they are pretty cordial. And they're very, because first of all, if you catch them right in the moment, sometimes they're in shock. I've never dealt with somebody like this where they're, like, a psychopath, right? Sociopath. But there is no reason to be an ass, like, not, I'm not going to say asshole, because morally and like emotionally, it's, I feel like it's justified. Like you're pissed off at what's occurred because someone has committed a crime against humanity and you are part of humanity, and that should piss you off. But when you're in a law enforcement capacity, you're supposed to meet force with force. You're not supposed to take on some character because you think that it's the emotional right way to, like you've said this before. Yeah. It just becomes vengeance at that point. And law enforcement is not supposed to do that. Because if we start doing that, then all of us are going to be in trouble. So we need to maintain that standard of professionalism. And like you said, it's a tactic. It's not because they want to be friendly to the murderer. It's a tactic.
Yeah.
Why escalate something and clam him up when he's being cooperative?
The other thing is of course, is you can be empathetic towards someone. You can understand their point of view, which in this case is very hard because this guy's barely human, if you ask me.
Yeah.
But you can be empathetic towards a suspect of whatever it is, whether it's shoplifting or whatever. You can be empathetic towards someone without condoning them. That is something a law enforcement officer has to do every day. You know, that's, again, just the drama of Law and Order. You have all these SVU detectives who are just having their guts, you know, ripped out, and they're dealing with all these like heavy-handed moral quandaries all the time. It's just like shit is happening. You have to confront that. You have to deal with it. You have to enforce the law. You have to do it dispassionately, without bias, and as a professional. And if you're not the type, if you don't have the temperament to go into this and be able to be professional with these people, again, not condoning what they did, but treat them respectfully as you're supposed to do, then you don't belong as a cop. And of course, none of the Law and Order cops belong as cops because they constantly violate civil rights and beat people up and cry over victims and stuff. I don't know why I keep mentioning SVU every single week. I guess I'm just still mad about that show, even though I haven't watched it in forever. But this show is over. Thank you, Kendra, for presenting Womansplaining, an excellent case.
Oh, really, you're welcome, John. Anytime.
Really enjoyed this one. If you want to catch the whole unedited version, go see our frenemies over at Explore With Us, because they frankly did all of the heavy lifting on this. I even accidentally borrowed a little bit from their AI narrator because it is very late at night and I didn't do a great job editing. If you wanted to send a case to Kendra, do not put it in the chat. I've told you 100 times. Email cases to truecrimedrama.
Stop doing that.
At gmail.com.
We're going to start yelling at you again.
That's truecrime, J-R-A-M-A, at gmail.com. You could send them over. And don't just send like, hey, do this Schenectady 7. Send a Wikipedia article. Send a picture. Send some sort of reference so that we have some place to start. As it turns out, there's been a lot of like crimes. So it's kind of hard to just kind of go off of something basic like that. So please do just a little bit of diligence for us and we'll do the rest. Send a case to truecrimedrama at gmail.com. Also, do you want to send a severed head to Kendra? You could do so at P.O. Box 1060, DeLand, Florida 32724. That's P.O. Box 1060, DeLand, Florida 32724. Kendra probably would not appreciate a human head. Also, think about the moral quandary there. Like when you go and you send something in the postmaster asks you, hey, does this contain anything hazardous? And if you mention to him, well, it does have a severed human head in it, they're probably going to think about like, well, it's got chemicals leaking out of there, you know, possibly a biohazard. They're not going to appreciate you sending a head through the post. And the last person you really want to run afoul of is the postmaster, not to mention the insane psychological damage it will do to your favorite true crime girl here on Failure Stop. So don't send a human head, but hair, teeth, fingernail clippings, all good stuff. Maybe a finger. Forget about the fucking toe, Kendra. You know, just a little snippet's fine, but not a whole head. Also, if you wanted to send cash, you could do that. This podcast is not monetized directly, you know, from things we get paid by Failure Stop. But if you want to pay just us and not little Elk and Tansy, like I said, we take cash, checks. Just go ahead and put them in the mail and send them on over to Kendra. And Kendra will give me my cut, I'm sure, in the form of alimony, because she is court ordered to maintain the level of living that I have become accustomed to. We are approaching 2 hours. Holy hell, people. We will catch you next week. Tomorrow's Wednesday, all the political news that you need without getting depressed. Thursday, sports are continuing to happen. I will cover sports on Friday. We got a big case breakdown. We take the weekend off like normal people, and then on Monday we come back on comedy. We will see you back here for True Crime next Tuesday. We appreciate you. Kendra, I love you, and I wish we can reconcile, and this whole podcast is just a cheap ploy in order to make that happen. We love you out there in the Wolfpack. Thank you so much for supporting us, as always. Guns up, giddy up, good night, America. Say goodbye, Kendra.
Goodbye. Don't don't murder people, and if you do, be very cooperative, and that's the only good thing that we could get from Brian, I think. It's just cooperate. But don't murder anyone.
Don't get yourself true crimed either. If you have to murder to keep yourself from being true crime.
Yeah.